Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 17. I will do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 41, as long as that sounds. I'm going to go fast. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 16, we looked at the wicked king Ahaz of Judah. Now we're back up to the north, and we'll look at Hoshea, the last king of northern Israel. So we start now in 2 Kings 17, 1 through 2, in the 12th year of Ahaz, who ruled from 732 to 716, king of Judah, Hoshea, who ruled from 732 to 722, the son of Elah became king over Israel and Samaria and reigned 9 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Now the 12th year of Ahaz is one of these time references that I cannot reconcile most of the time when I look at them, as the kings of the north and the kings of the south are compared in their reigns. That takes people like Thiele and people with PhDs in New Testament studies in order, Old Testament studies, to figure that kind of thing out. So I'm going to skip that. I'm just going to use the dates that Lambert Dolphin has put up on the internet. I think they work pretty good. I will say this, 722 is a very famous date that I've memorized and used over and over again. But unfortunately, the date guru Thiele disagrees and says it's 723 BC, a year earlier. Well, I'm not going to get into that. I'm just going to use 722 as the traditional date. Unfortunately, in a previous audio, I used 712 because I was looking at Lambert Dolphin's date chart, and apparently he had a typo in there, 712 instead of 722, and I was trying to say, well, maybe Hoshea ruled a rump there under the king of Assyria for 10 years. Well, no, it was a typo. My bad. If I could find it and go back and edit it out of the podcast, I would, but I can't find it, so I'm going to have to leave it. Now, in verse 2, it says that Hoshea did evil, but not as bad as the kings of Israel who were before him. Well, how was Hoshea not as evil as the previous northern Israelite kings? Well, first, before we discuss that, we need to discuss whether Hoshea did or did not worship the golden calves, as all the other previous kings of Israel did. There's two thoughts on that. John Gill says, no, Hoshea didn't worship the golden calves. He couldn't have, says Gill, because the golden calves were carried away in the previous Assyrian captivities. We're going to see here that Assyria raided Samaria, northern Israel, for a good bit and carried off a good bit of the northern Israelites. And so Gill speculates that the golden calves would have been taken off too. And so Hoshea was not as bad as the previous kings is because his regime didn't have golden calves. Well, that's speculative. Ellicott says that Hoshea, in fact, still did worship the golden calves. Here's the quote from Ellicott, quote, "We can hardly assume that Hoshea abandoned the calf worship of Bethel, but he may have discountenanced the cultus of the Baals and the Asherahs." Ellicott thus says that the reason that Hoshea was not as bad as the previous kings of Israel is because he laid off of worshiping Baal and Astarte. So here are our options as to how Hoshea was not as bad as the previous kings of Israel. Option number one, he didn't worship the Baals and Asherah. That's Ellicott's view. Option number two, he didn't worship the golden calves. That's Gill's view. Gill also says there's another option why he was not as bad, because he removed the barriers between Israel and Judah. He did this so that worshipers in the northern kingdom could go south to the southern kingdom of Judah, could go to Jerusalem and worship there. This was done on the 15th of Ab, the Jewish month Ab, and that actually later became a festival. We read about this in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 1. Now Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah and wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover to the Lord God of Israel. Well, if Hezekiah sent the invitation out, that presumes that the northerners could have accepted the invitation and come south to Jerusalem, and therefore Hoshea would have let them. Again, this is a lot of speculation here, but it's reasonable. Here's what Colin Delitzsch says about how Hoshea is not as bad as his predecessors. Quote, "We are not told in what Hoshea was better than his predecessors, nor can it be determined with any certainty. Although the assumption that he allowed his subjects to visit the temple at Jerusalem is a very probable one, inasmuch as, according to 2 Chronicles 30, verse 10, Hezekiah invited to the Feast of the Passover, held at Jerusalem, the Israelites from Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun, as far to the north, and some individuals from these tribes accepted his invitation. Colin Delitzsch quoted 2 Chronicles 30:10, which I'll read. The couriers traveled from city to city in the land of Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun, but the inhabitants laughed at them and mocked them. Well, they at least were invited to the party. They didn't go, but we can speculate that Hoshea would have let them go. Well, Hoshea, in whichever way, he was not as evil as his predecessors. He's still called evil. He's just not as evil. Note that the captivity of the northern Israelites, which occurred in 722 B.C., note that captivity occurred during the rule of a king who had reformed things a little bit. So the people couldn't blame their king for the captivity. They had only themselves to blame. We go now to 2 Kings 17, verses 3 through 4. Shalmaneser, that's Shalmaneser the Fifth, who ruled from 727 to 722. Shalmaneser the Fifth, king of Assyria, came up against Hoshea, and Hoshea, who ruled from 732 to 722, Hoshea became Shalmaneser the Fifth's servant and paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, Shalmaneser the Fifth, found conspiracy in Hoshea, who had sent messages to So, king of Egypt, and had offered no tribute to the king of Assyria, no tribute to Shalmaneser V, as he had done year by year. So the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. And that sounds like Shalmaneser V, but as we'll see, since Shalmaneser V died in 722 and Sargon II takes over in 722, it's a little bit questionable sometimes which king did what to whom. Now let's look at Shalmaneser V, what Wikipedia says about him. He ruled from 727 to 722. He's the king that comes right before Sargon II. His father was Tiglath-Pileser III, who ruled from 745 to 727. Shalmaneser taken over in 727. The revolt of Samaria, that's northern Israel, took place during Shalmaneser V's reign. While he was besieging the rebel city, he died 722 B.C., and the crown was seized by Sargon II. So sometime during the siege, he died. I've seen it speculated that maybe there was some dynastic struggles between Sargon II and Shalmaneser V, and maybe Sargon II actually killed him. I don't know. He died. So sometime in 722, so Shalmaneser V started the siege, and Sargon II finished the siege and affected the captivity of the northern Israelites. Now Hoshea, instead of continuing to pay tribute to Shalmaneser V, he thought, maybe I can get out of this, and so he looks to Egypt, another power in the ancient Near East, and he says, maybe Egypt can help me out, and I can ally myself with Egypt, and we can both go against Assyria. Bad move. Cost him his kingdom. Who this pharaoh of Egypt is, nobody knows. There's lots of problems in identifying which pharaoh this is. I have a nice web page link here, a URL, which you can't see, and it's about 30 miles long, so I can't tell you what it is, but that's something that you can research on your own, but it's speculative. So anyway, it's just a pharaoh of Egypt. So the king of Assyria shut Hoshea up and bound him in prison in verse 4. Now, there's two times, optionally, when Hoshea was imprisoned. He could have been imprisoned after the siege of Samaria was completed. The thinking that that's true is because Shalmaneser V would have had no way to capture Hoshea before the siege. Well, if that's true, if there has to be the siege first before Hoshea gets caught, well then, and if the imprisonment was after the siege, well then the prisoner would be Sargon II, not Shalmaneser V, because Sargon II is the guy who completed the siege and began the captivity. There's another view that it was Shalmaneser V who imprisoned Hoshea before the siege, before 722, because Sargon himself makes no mention of the capture or death of Hoshea. This is according to Ellicott. I assume he's talking about the Assyrian monuments. Sargon makes no mention of this. It doesn't really matter. One of the kings locked up the last king of Israel. We go to 2 Kings 17, verses 5 through 6. Then the king of Assyria invaded the whole land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. Now that's Shalmaneser V. Verse 6, 2 Kings 17, in the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and carried Israel away into exile to Assyria and settled them in Hala and Habor on the river Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. Now notice that the king of Assyria invaded the whole land. Israel couldn't even send out an army to slow Shalmaneser V down. These were the big boys of the ancient Near East. Northern Israel was just a rump little kingdom, half of a kingdom. This invasion shows how overmatched Israel was by Assyria. However, Samaria held out for 3 years, withstood a siege for 3 years, which shows that Samaria must have been well fortified, well provisioned, and well defended to hold out so long. But they fell, and then the king of Assyria, that would be Sargon II, he scattered the northern Israelites all through the Mesopotamian region to Assyria. The general area is called here in verse 6. Let's look at some of these particular places. First, some of the Jewish exiles went to Hala, which was a district of Media, which is northern Persia, northern present-day Iran. And some of the exiles were settled in Habor. That's the name of a river in Assyria, present-day Iraq. And it's also the name of the district through which the river flowed. Now, it's real easy to remember where the Habor River is, because if you go east from Israel, go across that desert there, the Arabian Desert, and you hit the Euphrates River, well, at the northern or the northwestern end of the Euphrates River, when the Euphrates River ends up in Syria, there is a tributary that runs into the Euphrates, and it looks like a Y. Well, the right side of the Y and the stem of the Y is the Habor River, and so that's where the people went. There is also a branch, and I've forgotten the name of the branch that runs in, the left branch of the Y that runs into the Habor River, but it's easily identifiable on the map. So, some Israelites were exiled to the Habor district at the Habor River. Some were sent to Gozan. As Easton's dictionary says, Gozan is a region in Central Asia to which the Israelites were carried away captive. It was situated in Mesopotamia on the river Habor, which is in 1 Chronicles 5:26 is called the River of Gozan. So that same Habor River, which I said, intersects the Euphrates River as it runs through Syria. And by the way, the Habor River runs into the Euphrates about 30 miles or so upstream. I should say downstream, excuse me. It's upstream from Mari, which is the famous archaeological tablets were found at Mari on the Euphrates River. Well, anyway, when the Habor River runs into the Euphrates, that area there is Gozan. And in the cities of the Medes, Media, of course, is northern Persia. In the ancient world, it was, and I assume it still is by the time that we're talking about here, which is the 8th century B.C. So, bye-bye, northern Israelites. Now, these northern Israelites, how are they treated? Well, we have some prophecies about this, and assuming, of course, that the prophecies came true, which I do assume, it was pretty bad. Shalmaneser V, or if it was Sargon II, whoever was besieging Samaria at the time, this is what it was like. Hosea 13:16, this is not Hoshea, this is Hosea the prophet. Hosea prophesied the early 9th century B.C. We are now at the end of the 8th century B.C. This is what Hosea prophesied. Chapter 13:16. Samaria will be held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They will fall by the sword. Their little ones will be dashed to pieces, and their pregnant women will be ripped open. Well, given the Assyrians' well-deserved reputation for cruelty, that would not surprise me in the least. The reason they ripped pregnant women open is not because they were afraid of the women or the children in the womb. They just wanted to terrorize the people so they wouldn't rebel anymore. We also read in Micah, verse 6 of chapter 1, Micah was a southern prophet in Judah, operated about the same time as Isaiah, late 8th century, which was just before, early 8th century. And, of course, 722, when northern Israel fell, was late 8th century. So he's just before this, and this is what he prophesies. Chapter 1, verse 6, "For I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. I will pour her stones down into the valley, and I will lay bare her foundations." Tear the houses down and throw the rocks down the hill. Heap of ruins. Now, these northern Israelites were, of course, carried off to the aforementioned cities in the ancient Near East. Their ultimate destination, these are the so-called Lost Ten Tribes, which I'm sure you have heard of before. Those Lost Ten Tribes and their final destination is endlessly speculated upon. I think you got British Israelism, and the Mormons have got some cultish answers to that question. They lost. That's why they call them lost tribes. They never were found again. They're gone. Now, some of them might have joined up with the exiles in Babylon after the southern kingdom's exile in 586 B.C., and they came back in 537. So maybe they came back with those pilgrims from Babylon coming back to Israel, possibly, but nobody knows. They're gone. Now, when I say they were lost, I mean they were ultimately lost. We know from verse 6 that the first place they were shipped out to, the first places they were shipped out to were Hala, which is in Media, Habor on the river of Gozan, and then Gozan itself, which is the district where Habor intersects the Euphrates, and in the cities of the Medes, which is indistinct. So that's where they first went to, but now they're lost. They're the 10 lost tribes of Israel, and nobody knows what happened to them. 2 Kings 17, verses 7 through 10. Now this came about, all this disaster. This came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God. Now, what we're going to see here is a whole list of sins that the Israelites did for the purpose of showing that the idolatry caused the disaster. I'm going to probably take this a verse at a time. Now this came about, this disaster came about because the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and in the customs of the kings of Israel, which they had introduced. Now, our author of 2 Kings, probably Jeremiah, he points out that, you know, Yahweh drove out all the other gods of the Canaanites. And so maybe you Israelites would be smart enough to worship the God who won those battles and not worship the gods of the people who lost. But no, the Israelites worshiped the Baals, the Astartes, the Canaanite religion, as well as the golden calves. Notice that the northern Israelites, the sons of Israel, they sinned because of their worship of the gods of the Canaanite nations, the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out. That's the Canaanites. But also, they walked in the customs of the kings of Israel. And that's, of course, referring to the golden calves, which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, 931 to 910 BC, he had introduced that, and they walked in that. All right, so it's because of idolatry and false Yahweh worship that the disasters occurred to northern Israel. And Hosea and Israel got wiped out in 722. The kingdom of Samaria, the northern kingdom of Israel, is Kaputsky. Verse 9, the sons of Israel, as the northern Israelites, did things secretly which were not right against the Lord their God. Secretly. Well, the Israelites had enough sense of what was right for the Israelites to be ashamed. So they secretly worshipped their idols. Well, they might have been smart enough to be ashamed for their idolatry, but they weren't smart enough to realize you can't hide anything from an omniscient God. That was pretty dumb. Most idolatry is dumb. Most of the human race is dumb because most of the human race is idolatrous. So in verse 9, these northern Israelites built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. Watchtower is a very rural place where people sat on a tower to watch the sheep. Fortified city, of course, is an urban place. So basically from rural places to urban places, in other words, everywhere there was idolatry. High places. Now, I am never sure whether the high places are places for the golden calves to be worshipped or whether they're places for pagan idols to be worshipped, such as Baal and Astarte or the host of heaven or whatever. I don't know. It probably doesn't matter here. The point is, this is a general condemnation of their idolatrous conduct. Verse 10, they set for themselves, the Israelites did, the northern Israelites, they set for themselves sacred pillars and Asherim wooden poles to worship Astarte or Asherah. The wooden pole was an Asherah. Asherim is plural. Sacred pillars of some kind of god. I think that was to worship Baal. On every high hill and under every green tree, that's because they would put these idolatrous places in a grove of trees to make their worship pleasant. Now, a couple of things I omitted going through verses 7 through 10. In verse 7, it mentions that God had brought them up from the land of Egypt. That shows that God had a lot of grace to get them out of slavery. And it's mentioned here to show what God had done, because compared to what God had done, in contrast to that, is what the Israelites had done. Worshipped every other god but Yahweh, the same Yahweh that brought them up out of Egypt. We go now to 2 Kings 17, verses 11 through 17. And there they burned incense on all the high places, as the nations did, which the Lord had carried away to exile before them. And they did evil things, provoking the Lord. All the nations which the Lord had carried away, that's the Canaanites, that God had busted with the Israelites coming in there, carried them away to exile. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it means that the Canaanites got beaten. So just as they had gotten carried away for idolatry, now the Israelites are going to get carried away for idolatry by Sargon II. What goes around comes around. Verse 12, they served idols, the Israelites did, concerning which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this thing. When did God say, don't do this thing? Exodus 20, verses 3 through 5, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. Exodus 20, verse 23, you shall not make other gods besides me. Gods of silver or gods of gold, you shall not make for yourselves, clear as a bell. No wiggle room there, no room for interpretation. Yet they worshipped other idols. Verse 13, 2 Kings 17, yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all his prophets and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments, my statutes according to all the law which I commanded your fathers, and which I sent to you through my servants the prophets. However, they did not listen, but stiffened their neck like their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord their God. So in verse 13, the author reminds the Israelites of all the prophets who had given these commands to turn away from idolatry. What prophets might he have been referring to? Well, let me mention some. Ahijah the Shilonite, who told Jeroboam the first that the 10 tribes were going to be torn away from Israel because of Judah's sin. Elijah, Elisha, Hosea, Amos, Micah, these are northern prophets. Got a good mnemonic device to remember them. And electrical engineer Ham. So I picture a ham radio operator in Samaria on the map. He's also an electrical engineer because he's a electronic nerd. And the A stands for Ahijah the Shilonite, who prophesied against Jeremiah the First. Electrical engineer is E.E., Elijah and Elisha. And Ham is Hosea, Amos, and Micah. Micah, there's your northern prophets. Ahijah the Shilonite, Elijah, Elisha, Hosea, Amos, and Micah. There were others too, but those were the main ones. The result, of course, was not salutary. The Israelites rejected those prophets. Verse 15, they rejected his statutes and his covenant, which God had made with their fathers, and his warnings, which Yahweh warned them. Here's an example of these warnings. Deuteronomy 4:26, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but will be utterly destroyed. That's right. If they came over in 1200 and made it to 722, well, that's 5 centuries, but could have been longer. Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today, is God speaking, that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants. People on this earth have got a choice. They can serve God and be blessed, or they can serve the world, the flesh, and the devil and be cursed. It's just as simple as that. Maybe not quite that simple, because sometimes the righteous do suffer, yes, but they are also delivered from their troubles and comforted in their troubles, whereas the unrighteous have troubles too. And the only comfort they get is knowing that they're going to die, and they pretend that they're going to heaven, but they're not, because their sins are not covered. So, why not choose life? The Israelites were warned, but they didn't listen. Continuing in verse 15, 2 Kings 17, and they followed vanity and became vain and went after the nations which surrounded them, concerning which the Lord had commanded them not to do like them. Here's another verse where God had commanded them not to do like the pagan nations. Deuteronomy 6:13 and 14. You shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you. But they did it. They rejected his statutes and his covenant, which he made with their fathers, and his warnings. They followed vanity, became vain, went after the nations which surrounded them, concerning which the Lord had commanded them not to do like them. They forsook, verse 16, 2 Kings 17, they forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God and made for themselves molten images, even 2 calves, and made an Asherah, that's a wooden pole, to Astarte, and worshipped all the host of heaven, that's the stars in the sky, and served Baal. Then they made their sons and their daughters pass through the fire. That's probably passing through the fire of Molech. Molech is famous for requiring live children as sacrifices. And this is what the Israelites did. We know that King Ahaz did the same thing in the south. The Israelites did it here in the north. They practiced divination and enchantments. That's out and out demon worship. And sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him. Well, that's pretty provoking. Sounds like America almost. Now, this passing through the fire that the Israelites did, that was to worship Molech, as I said. Gill says that Baal is the same as Molech. I'm not sure about that. I'm not an expert on the idols of the ancient Near East, but whatever idol it was, it required child sacrifice. Now, some people say that it's passing through the fire means just moving the child forward and backward through two sets of flames and not burning him. Some say it just means singeing the kid or scorching him, kind of. I believe it means burning him up. I read some scriptures in the last audio in which I think, to me at least, very clearly showed that child sacrifice was burning the kid up. And that's what the God's chosen people were doing. 2 Kings 17, verses 18 through 20. So the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah. That's, of course, referring to the exile of the northern Israelites in 722 B.C. to Assyria, leaving only Judah. Now, that's speaking generally because the southern kingdom consisted not only of Judah, but also Benjamin, which was annexed to Judah. Gill says it was part of Benjamin. I don't know what part he's talking about, but let's just say Benjamin and Judah was down there. Also, Simeon was scattered through. Simeon had tribes scattered through Judah. And then, of course, the priests and the Levites who had fled the golden calf worship at the time of Jeroboam I. The priests and the Levites had gone down to Judah. And then, of course, various individuals of the northern tribes might have migrated down there. I imagine it. Their border was probably about as porous as the American border is now as I speak in 2022. So they were probably down there in Judah too. So that's what was left. But just generally to summarize it, you got Judah. That's all that's left of God's chosen people. Verse 19, also Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God. Not only northern Israel acted like a bunch of idolatrous horses' asses, but also Judah did. They did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the customs which Israel had introduced. Well, that's, of course, is referring to golden calf worship. Golden calf worship was introduced by people from Israel into the southern kingdom. So now the southern kingdom, under Ahaz, they worship Baal, Astarte, the host of heaven, the stars, and they are also worshiping golden calves. So the pollution, the corruption is going in the wrong direction, going away from pure Yahweh worship. Verse 20, the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. The plunderers of Israel would include Hazael, who ruled from 841 to 801, and Ben-Hadad II, who ruled from 860 to 841. So we're talking about last half of the 9th century. And Tiglath-Pileser, those are Syrian kings. And of course, all these kings that we've been talking about, like Ahab, they're constant opponent was the Syrians. Now that the Syrians have kind of gone away because of the Assyrians, Tiglath-Pileser III, who of course was the biggest Assyrian of them all, he came in and plundered the northern kingdom. We've already seen that in a previous chapter. So all of these plunderers, Syrian and Assyrian kings, had come in, afflicted the northern Israelites, and then God cast the northern Israelites out of his sight by allowing them to be carried captive by Sargon II. Some rough language. Sin has its consequences. It's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of our God who is a consuming fire. 2 Kings 17, 21 through 23. When he, that's Yahweh, had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king, the house of Israel did. Then Jeroboam drove Israel. That's Jeroboam I, 931 to 910 B.C., Then Jeroboam I drove Israel away from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. Of course, that great sin was setting up the golden calf temples and worship in Dan and Bethel. Verse 22, 2 Kings 17, the sons of Israel, that's northern Israel, walked in all the sins of Jeroboam I, which he did. They did not depart from them until Yahweh removed Israel from his sight, northern Israel. As Yahweh spoke through all his servants the prophets, so Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria until this day. And that, of course, is talking about what we just read about, Assyria's Sargon II carrying off Israel in 722 B.C. Verse 21 says, when Yahweh had torn Israel from the house of David, that's an expressive verb because this tearing away was prophesied by the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite, who accosted Jeroboam I as he was leaving Jerusalem, and he said in 1 Kings 11:30 through 31, We read this, "Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he had on, tore it into 12 pieces, and said to Jeroboam, 'Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord God of Israel says. I am about to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hands. I will give you 10 tribes.'" And so that's why in verse 21, the text says, "When Yahweh had torn Israel from the house of David," of course, that's the southern kingdom of David, of Judah, which was ruled by the house of David, the tribe of David, tribe of Judah. Now, in verse 23, the text says that Yahweh removed Israel from his sight. Here's what Jameson Fawcett and Brown has to say concerning this removal. Quote, "It must not be supposed that the Israelites were universally removed to a man. A remnant was left, chiefly, however, of the poor and lower classes with whom these foreign colonists mingled, so that the prevailing character of society about Samaria was heathen, not Israelite. For the Assyrian colonists became masters of the land, and forming partial intermarriages with the remnant Jews, the inhabitants became a mongrel race, no longer a people of Ephraim, no longer a people of northern Israel. These people, imperfectly instructed in the creed of the Jews, acquired also a mongrel doctrine, being too few to replenish the land, lions by which the land had been infested multiplied and committed frequent ravages upon them." And so that's where we get the Samaritans, whom Jesus discussed as he walked through Samaria and met the Samaritan woman near Shechem at the Jacob's well there at Sychar. Now, the northern Israelites were carried away into exile, verse 23, until this day. That would be at the time of the writing of the book, and it's most likely between 561 and 538. You see that number a lot. This particular number came from thebiblebrief.com, but I've seen it elsewhere, where the Jewish traditions say that Jeremiah wrote the book. But as BibleBrief.com says, the evidence for Jeremiah is inconclusive. And they haven't returned even to this day as I speak in 2022, and I don't think they ever will. Those are the 10 lost tribes. Bye-bye, lost to history. We go down to 2 Kings 17, verse 24. "The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cuthah and from Avah and from Hamath and Sepharvaim and settled them in the cities of Samaria in place of the sons of Israel. So they possessed Samaria and lived in its cities." Now we see where the incoming foreigners, pagan foreigners, are coming from. First from Babylon. We know where Babylon is. That's on the Euphrates River, about halfway down, north to south, or northwest to southeast. Cuthah is, I would say, 5 miles to the northeast of Babylon, right between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. This is according to the map in BibleAtlas.org's website. So that's Cuthah. Avah is also on the Euphrates River. That's a little bit to the north. You don't go as far as to where the Habor River, which I mentioned earlier, the Habor River runs into the Euphrates in Syria. Well, you don't go that far up the river. You go northeast of Babylon, but you don't go all the way up to the Habor River. So southwest of the Habor River is Avah. And then the next place that the incoming colonists came from was Hamath. That's the famous Hamath on the Orontes River, which runs in the Anti-Lebanon Valley there, the Orontes Valley. It runs south to north and dumps into the Mediterranean Sea. Hamath is a very well-known place there, present-day Lebanon. Sepharvaim is on the Tigris River, northeast of Babylon. If you go up the Euphrates River from Babylon and then right at in the neck there where the Euphrates and Tigris gets close together, and you hop on over east to the Tigris River is a place called Opis, which is known in ancient history. You go up the Tigris River, I don't know, about 30 miles, and you get to Sepharvaim. This is according to BibleAtlas.org, but they do have a question mark, so they're not exactly sure where that is. But basically, the incoming foreigners came from the Mesopotamian Valley and from the Orontes Valley, too, which makes sense. They were nearby. We go now to 2 Kings 17, verses 25 through 28. "When they first lived there," that's the settlers, the foreign pagans that the Assyrians brought in, "when they first lived there in the promised land, they did not fear Yahweh, so the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. The settlers spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, 'The nations that you have deported and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the requirements of the God of the land. Therefore, he, the God of the land, has sent lions among them that are killing them because the people don't know the requirements of the God of the land.' Then the king of Assyria issued a command, send back one of the priests you deported. Have him go. The command was sent to the people in Samaria, the governors. Send back one of the priests you deported. Have him go and live there so he can teach them the requirements of the God of the land. So one of the priests they had deported came and lived in Bethel, and he began to teach them how they should fear Yahweh. He came to live in Bethel because that's where the golden calf was. So this is a golden calf priest that came back. So the mention here by our author of 2 Kings that the lions had come back, the same lions that the Israelites had cleared out. Well, the lesson to be learned from this is God can clear out Israelites just as fast as he can clear out pagans. That's what happens when civilization breaks down. The lions take over because the settlers can't keep the lions out of their cities and villages. So these settlers from the ancient Near East, from the Mesopotamian Valley, they're basically starting over. Now, it's a perfectly natural thing for lions to take over when settlers cannot occupy the whole land, but behind that natural occurrence was God's supernatural hand. In verse 25, we read, the Lord sent lions among them, because God is the God of providence, the God of nature, as well as a supernatural God. He wants the people to turn to Yahweh, to realize they can't make it on their own without Yahweh. And the priest that came back, that the Assyrian king, whoever he was, sent back, that priest was not a pagan priest. He was a golden calf Yahweh priest. So he was worshiping the right God under the wrong form, which is not good, but it's a lot better than a Baal or Astarte priest, or priest that worships the stars of heaven, or Molech. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that the Assyrian king who sent the priest back was Esarhaddon, who ruled from 681 to 669. I don't have the foggiest notion of how Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown know that. I don't think anybody knows. Now, Adam Clark says concerning this golden calf priest that the Assyrian king sent back, he was imperfect, but he must have had an impact against idolatry. Here's what Clark says, quote, in the end, he overthrew the idolatry of these people, so that soon after the Babylonian captivity, they were found to be as free from idolatry as the Jews themselves, and continue so to the present day. But they are now nearly annihilated. Clark's present day was the 19th century, 1800s, and so they got rid of their idolatry. They got rid of the Baals and the Astartes. Interesting. In this case, the movement was upward with golden calves, but from the pure worship of Yahweh, golden calves are a movement downwards. Remember the story of the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4? She's talking to Jesus and she said, we Samaritans worship God. Here, she was referring to the temple on Mount Gerizim, near north of Shechem. But she didn't say we worship Baal or Astarte. She says, we worship Yahweh, we worship God. Now, of course, she was worshiping in the wrong place. I don't know whether they still had the golden calves that late or not. Probably not, but it was still Yahweh. So paganism had been wiped out of Samaria. We go to 2 Kings 17, verses 29 through 33. But the people of each nation were still making their own gods in the cities where they lived and putting them in the shrines of the high places that the people of Samaria had made. Now, those high places were pagan high places, I'm sure. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth. The men of Cuth made Nergal. The men of Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak. And the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of the Sepharvaim. Now, I'm going to go through the cities here because of the same cities we just talked about. Babylon on the Euphrates River, of course, is the famous Babylon. And then Cuth, which is the same thing as Cuthah, we've already talked about. That was about 10 miles northeast of Babylon. Hamath is on the Orontes River in the Anti-Lebanon-Lebanon Valley there. Famous place. Ava is north of Babylon on the Euphrates River. Sepharvaim is probably over on the Tigris River, northeast of Babylon. So all of their idols are mentioned. I'm not going to go through the idols. I'm not sure people know exactly who these idols are. I will mention one idol, the idol of Babylon, named Succoth-Benoth. Translated, that means tabernacles of the young women. As soon as I read that, I said, that doesn't sound good. And I looked at Clark, and yes, he said, this refers to public prostitution of young virgins to Venus, which the Babylonians did. So they had a temple up there where you could go worship your god by having sex with a priestess. What a religion. John Gill says that women once in their lives prostituted themselves to whomsoever asked them in honor of Venus. In other words, it sounds like the temple prostitutes were virgins. So you got to have a virgin while you worship your god. That sounds like a megachurch trying to get people into their doors to put money in the plate by offering basketball courts, which is just about as enticing as a virgin would be. And the results are just about the same. Now, I said I wasn't going to mention these gods, but I will mention two other ones, Adramelech and Amalek, the gods of the Sepharvaim. Those are the ones on the Tigris River. Notice the Molech, the Molech, the Molech at the end of both of those names. These were forms of Molech. And Molech, of course, is famous for child sacrifice, burning children in the fire to these gods. Now, verse 32 said that these settlers in Samaria feared the Lord. Now, that's interesting. After all this idolatry, well, that means they worshiped externally the Lord and probably in the form of the golden calves. So they just mixed in Yahweh worship with all the other idols because they were syncretists and idolaters. They also appointed for the number of priests to serve them in the shrines of the high places. Now, that's a little bit ambiguous. At least the Holman Christian Study Bible translation makes it sound ambiguous because it says in verse 32, they feared the Lord. Okay, that's Yahweh worship. But on the other hand, they appointed from their number of priests to serve in the shrines of the high places. So that makes it sound like they appointed pagan priests to serve in their pagan shrines to worship their pagan gods on high places. But most of the commentators say that no, that's not what it is. These settlers feared Yahweh, means externally worshiped Yahweh, and they appointed these pagans, took some of their pagan compadres and set up priests to worship, to serve this golden calf Yahweh. Let me read you some other translations to make it clearer than the Holman Christian Study Bible does. 2 Kings 17:32, New American Bible. They also venerated the Lord, Yahweh, choosing from their number priests for the high places who officiated for them in the shrines on the high places. That sounds like they venerated Yahweh, and then they got priests. And I assume that their priests learned how to venerate Yahweh from the priest that was sent by the Assyrian king to teach them. 2 Kings 17:32, New American Standard Bible. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves priests of the high places. That's Yahweh, who acted for them in the houses of the high places. 2 Kings 17:32, so they went on worshiping the Lord and made for themselves from among all the people priests for the high places. That's for Yahweh. 2 Kings 17:32, Darby, so they feared Jehovah, that's Yahweh, and made to themselves from all classes of them priests of the high places. So the and there, they feared Jehovah and made priests. They feared Jehovah and made priests for the high places. They feared Yahweh and instead of but. And so God's word translation says, so while these people were worshiping the Lord, they also appointed all kinds of people to serve as priests. It never explicitly says priest for Yahweh, but I think it's reasonable to assume that that's exactly what it means. So this is a syncretist religion. Idolatry everywhere with God thrown in. Again, sounds like Americans who go to church on Christmas and Easter. Verse 33, these are the Mesopotamian settlers that the Assyrians had brought in. They feared the Lord. They worshipped him externally. But they also worshipped their own gods according to the custom of the nations where they had been deported from. There's both and syncretism, which God does not like, by the way. By the way, on that controverted passage in verse 32, they feared the Lord, but they appointed from their number priests to serve them. I said it could be pagan priests to serve in pagan high places. And I gave you the translations to make it sound like, no, it wasn't pagan high places. It was Yahweh worship. Well, the commentators Benson, Collin, Delitzsch, and Poole agree with that statement. And Poole says the reason is that foreign pagans would not need priests to instruct them how to worship their own gods. But here the implication is they had to be instructed because they had to get that priest sent back by the Assyrian king. And so it makes sense that the verse mentioned here is referring to Yahweh priest, golden calf Yahweh priest, who have learned from the returned golden calf Yahweh priest. We go now to 2 Kings 17, verses 34 through 41. To this day they do according to the earlier customs. They do not fear the Lord, nor do they follow their statutes or their ordinances or the law or the commandments which the Lord commanded the sons of Jacob when he named Israel, whom he named Israel. Now the they is ambiguous. There's two options as to what the referent could be. As Matthew Poole says, the they could refer to the Samaritans in Palestine. And if so, then the purpose of this little section is to show how the Samaritans didn't follow their statutes, they didn't follow their laws, and their pagans, just like the Samaritans didn't do it, neither did Israel do it. And then this digression would end at verse 41, which says, while these nations fear the Lord, again referring to the pagan nations, they also serve their idols. I don't think so. Matthew Poole says, no. The they there is the Israelites who are in exile. In other words, your options are they're the Samaritans in Palestine, or it's the Israelites in exile. And the Israelites in exile is, quote unquote, unquestionably the correct option, as Matthew Poole says. So now we have switched from the northern Israelites in Palestine to the northern Israelites in exile, wherever they were scattered to all in the Assyrian Empire. And incidentally, they weren't necessarily scattered to those five cities that the Assyrians came from, Babylon, Cuthah, Sepharvaim, Hamath. That's where the incoming people came from, but the outgoing Israelites didn't necessarily go there. Continuing with verse 35, 2 Kings 17, Israel, with whom the Lord made a covenant and commanded them, saying, you shall not fear other gods, nor bow down yourselves to them, nor serve them, nor sacrifice to them. Now that prohibition not to bow down to other gods is in the first and second of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me, and so forth. But they did it anyway. Verse 36, but the Lord who brought you up from the land of Egypt with great power and with an outstretched arm, him you shall fear, and to him you shall bow yourselves down, and to him you shall sacrifice. The statutes and the ordinances and the law and the commandment which he wrote for you, that's at Mount Sinai, you shall observe to do forever. Now let's stop a minute. Forever? Even during the new covenant? No. The Mosaic law is not in effect during the new covenant. That forever means, well, there's several ways you can handle forever. You can split the Old Testament Sinaitic law up into parts, the judicial, the moral, and the ceremonial, and say, well, the moral law lasts forever. That's the typical Reformed answer. And I am a New Covenant guy. I absolutely cannot stand it when Reformers do that. You can't slice the law up into thirds and have one-third of it come through and then two-thirds of it stay blocked by the cross. No, I think the best way to explain that forever, they're supposed to observe those commandments forever. The word forever just means for a long time. You can look in a lexicon, Hebrew lexicon, I think it's olam, means for a long time. Doesn't mean eternally, it just means for a long time. Like, man, that exam lasted forever. I thought I'd never get out. If you say that, that doesn't mean you're going to be taking an exam till eternity. It just means it's a long exam. And, of course, another way you can look at it is you'll observe the Mosaic law forever as long as the Mosaic law is in effect. Just that was understood. And once it's not in effect anymore, when the new covenant comes in, then the old covenant law is kaputsky. Of course, if you are Reformed, you're not going to believe that. Well, just forget I said that and close your ears to that section of the tape and we'll move on to the next verse. Verse 38, the covenant that I have made with you, you shall not forget, nor shall you fear other gods. But the Lord your God you shall fear, and he will deliver you from the hand of all your enemies. However, they did not listen, but they did according to their early custom, which was, of course, idolatry, golden calf worship. So while these nations feared the Lord, they also served their idols. Now here in verse 41, we're switching back to the Assyrians that had come into the land. We're not talking about the northern Israelites who used to be in the land, but have now been carried out. We're now talking about the pagan nations that have come into the land, because it says these nations, plural. Those nations, as the pulpit commentary says, are the Babylonians, the Cutheans, the Hamathites, the Avites, and the Sepharvites. Those are the ones I've just mentioned, already talked about. And so now in verse 41, we're talking about the pagans who have come into the land. They serve their idols, their children, their grandchildren, their descendants, as their fathers did, all the way down to this day, which is 6th century probably in the time of Jeremiah. So, there was idolatry in the land before God spewed them out, and there's idolatry in the land after the new folks came in. And that, my friends, is the story of the origin of Samaria, where the Samaritan woman was from. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've finished now with this long chapter, 1 Kings 17. We are now ready in our next audio to go to 2 Kings 18, verses 1 through 37, and we will look at the famous story of Hezekiah, the king of Judah, fighting Sennacherib of Assyria. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.